just offshore, reeking and crawling with rats. The islands were eventually consolidated into one landmass and named Brickell Key. Starting in the late 1970s, developers built a bridge connecting it to the mainland and began erecting a series of soaring condominium towers that were mostly sold to wealthy buyers from Latin America. Most didn't live there full-time, creating an eerily quiet enclave just across a narrow canal from one of Miami's busiest districts. Brickell Key is largely hidden behind locked gates and patrolled by security guards. One of its only public spaces is the five-star 295-room Mandarin Oriental, a grand hotel that is among Miami's finest. Early on the morning of May 3, 2013, Jared Randall, accompanied by another FBI agent and a translator, approached the front desk at the Mandarin Oriental. He identified himself, showed his badge, and asked the clerk to call Jose Javila's room and request that he come down. Javila, bald with a soft chin, wire-rimmed glasses, and big dark eyes, had been sound asleep with his wife. It was not yet 6:30 in the morning, but he quickly got dressed and went to the lobby to see what this was all about. It was natural to feel nervous, especially as a foreigner, when the FBI showed up unannounced. Choosing his words with care, Randall told the surprised Brazilian that the government was investigating corruption in soccer. Then Randall made a point of formally admonishing Avila, telling him deliberately that before they went any further, he needed to understand that any lies or misrepresentations could be considered criminal acts. Avila, speaking in Portuguese, identified himself and acknowledged that he owned Traffic, which had its Miami offices on the fourth floor of a building on Brickell Key, not 100 yards away from the hotel. Then Randall cut to the chase. Had Javila ever bribed Ricardo Teixeira, Nicolas Leos, or Julio Grondona, the Argentine Soccer Association president? No, Javila responded. Traffic was a clean company that did things the right way. It didn't engage in that sort of conduct, he emphasized, and never had. What about Chuck Blazer? Randall asked. Had Traffic or its intermediaries ever bribed Chuck Blazer or offered to do so? No, Avila replied. Did he know about any companies that had been used to send money to Blazer? No, Avila repeated. Could he recall if any money had ever been sent to Blazer on Traffic's behalf through a company in Panama? No. What about a company in Uruguay? No, Avila insisted. He had no memory of any of that. Calmly, Randall repeated the questions several times, accompanying Avila to the hotel's restaurant, where the Brazilian ordered coffee and breakfast. The agent did not partake. And then, after no more than 15 minutes, the brief interview concluded. Randall thanked Avila for his time and departed, leaving the South American executive puzzled and shaken. It had been a stressful few months. In early 2013, Avila had finally put most of his newspapers up for sale. His many attempts to turn the small dailies around had done little to slow the precipitous decline in circulation. And even after laying off 80 employees, the bleeding just wouldn't stop. He'd finally admitted defeat, preparing to write them off as a near-total loss. Then, Avila had flown to Buenos Aires to firm up plans for the Copa America deal with his former rivals. They'd gotten together on March 13th in Full Play's offices on the 13th floor of a shiny office tower, just blocks from the Estadio Monumental, Argentina's largest and most storied soccer venue, where the country's national team beat Holland to win its first World Cup title 35 years earlier. About 15 people were in the meeting, and the executives and their lawyers went over the three-way shareholders agreement, as well as technical aspects of the partnership, allocating responsibilities for each company. Torneos would be in charge of production of the Copa America, Traffic would sell sponsorships, and Full Play would sell broadcast rights and also administer this new three-headed company they were forming, which they called Tatisa. The Hinkises of Full Play and Alejandro Bursaco of Torneos said they had negotiated to pay CONMEBOL $80 million for each edition of the tournament, including the Centenario edition in 2016. That was a substantial premium over the old price, but considering how much soccer rights had appreciated in recent years, and how many editions of the Copa America the contract covered, everyone agreed it was a bargain. The meeting happened to fall on the same day that Jorge Bergoglio, the Archbishop of Buenos Aires, was elected the first South American pope, and the Vatican's announcement interrupted the meeting. Jubilant Argentines had taken to the streets to celebrate Pope Francis, and Avila and Burzaco used the opportunity to take a walk together. The two men had known each other for some time, and got along well. As they strolled, Burzaco confided to Avila that all three South American members of FIFA's ExCo had solicited bribes in exchange for their votes on where to hold the 2022 World Cup, and had agreed to split $5 million to endorse Qatar. But it later came out, Burzaco said, that Ricardo Teixeira from Brazil had actually negotiated a $50 million bribe for the votes, and kept nearly all of it for himself, infuriating the other two officials, Julio Grondona and Nicolas Leos, when they learned the truth. It was a terrible revelation, Avila thought, a profound corruption of the sport's most important event. But it somehow felt dismally predictable. He recalled Teixeira once showing him a very expensive watch he'd gotten from Mohammed bin Hammam, and it all began to make sense. He wasn't the only one who couldn't escape the bribes. It was impossible to be involved in the soccer business without them. When the two men returned to Full Play's offices, Mariano Hincas said he wanted to meet with them privately. Avila knew right away what the topic would be. Sure enough, Hincas and Burzaco told him that they had paid large bribes to a dozen South American officials, including the entire Group of Six, to secure the Copa America, and had pledged to keep paying them for each successive edition of the tournament. So far, the tally was $40 million, Hincas said. And as an equal partner in Datisa, Traffic owed a third of that. He also would be expected, Hincas reminded him, to withdraw the lawsuit he filed against Full Play and CONMEBOL as soon as possible. Avila felt sickened. He had foolishly hoped this deal was different. But he put up no resistance. He had a flight back to Brazil in an hour, and felt desperate to escape the conversation. Mariano Hincas followed him on the way out, explaining that Avila would never have to make the bribe payments directly. He preferred, he insisted, to handle them himself. "You can be calm," Hincas said, smiling broadly, "because I already took care of everything." Avila had come to Miami at the outset of May for a brief visit mainly to close on a property he was purchasing on Fisher Island. Studded with luxury condos arrayed around one of America's highest-rated golf courses, Fisher Island's zip code was the wealthiest in the whole country. For $6.5 million, half of it cash, Avila was buying a 4,400-square-foot, three-bedroom unit on the island's Atlantic-facing side, just above a man-made beach that featured fine white sand imported from the Bahamas. The unexpected interruption from the FBI had come on a Friday, and Avila was set to meet his lawyer for the formal closing on the condo the following Tuesday. He'd be back in Brazil in less than a week. Over the weekend, however, it was hard for him not to dwell on what had happened. How much did the FBI know? Where was this young agent getting so much information about old business affairs? It was puzzling. And then on Monday, Avila's phone rang. It was, of all people, Chuck Blazer. Speaking Spanish, Blazer shocked Avila, saying that FBI agents had come to his apartment that very morning asking probing questions about his Cayman Islands bank account and about two companies, one from Uruguay, another from Panama. Did Avila have any idea, he wondered, what was going on and how much the FBI knew? "Please, I am asking you as a friend to leave us out of this because of the investigation," Avila replied, becoming upset. "They went to visit me, too," he continued. "Two people from the FBI, they also visited me." "You?" Blazer asked, a seeming note of surprise in his husky baritone. Avila explained that the agents had asked repeatedly about transfers of money to Blazer from accounts in Uruguay and Panama, and that he'd replied that he didn't know anything. "They asked me if there were payments outside the contract," the Brazilian continued. "I don't know. The truth is, I don't know. I only ask that you not mention us because otherwise it will involve us in a very serious problem, you know?" Blazer had started covertly recording phone calls with Avila nearly a year earlier. After telling Norris and the rest of the team about Traffic's decades of bribery, he had combed through his old archives in search of documentary evidence. He recalled receiving six-figure payments related to the Gold Cup contracts he'd signed with Avila's companies, and eventually found a handful of documents from 1999 and 2000 showing wires to his bank account in the Cayman Islands. The wires, for $200,000, $100,000, and $99,985, came from accounts for companies based in Uruguay and Panama. The firms, Tansy S.A. and Metrobank S.A., didn't have any obvious connection to Traffic. But Blazer clarified that was because Avila was careful and almost always used intermediaries to make wires on his behalf, so the payments to the officials wouldn't be on his books. There were, in fact, a host of shell companies that Avila's trusted bagmen used to make payments. Digging further, Blazer also found the phony contract he and Avila had created to explain the $600,000 wire he'd received in 2003, as well as the emails he'd sent to the Brazilian about the money at the time. The prosecutors were increasingly convinced that Avila, if they could get him to flip, would be an incredible asset to the case. Snaring someone who for decades had been the one paying the bribes could blow the case wide open. A man like Avila could prove just as valuable, if not more so, than a Jack Warner. Avila was the one paying the bribes. That meant he could lead them to who knows how many corrupt officials and provide the paperwork to prove it. Blazer, based on memory and the documents he'd dug up, had provided a strong lead, but it wasn't quite enough. They needed to prove that Avila had knowledge of the payments despite the fact that his fingerprints weren't directly on them. Wires from Traffic to Tansy or Metrobank at roughly the same time those shell companies sent money to Blazer, and for the same amount of money, for example, would definitely help close the loop. The easy solution, Berryman suggested, was to subpoena Delta National Bank and Trust Co. in Miami, which he'd identified through correspondent bank transfers as one of Traffic's two main U.S. banks, and the one it appeared to use for bribe payments. If any bribes had originated from Delta, the IRS agent reasoned, they would pop up immediately. But Norris refused. Delta wasn't some giant like Wells Fargo or Chase. It was a tiny private bank with just three branches in the whole world. It had been doing business with Traffic for so long, it was possible, if not likely, that its bankers would tip off Avila or some other Traffic employee about the subpoena. The risk was just too great. Instead, they decided to make Blazer pick up the phone. Unlike a lot of cooperators, he seemed to have no compunctions about making covert recordings. In fact, at times, Blazer seemed to relish it. If he could trick Avila into admitting he'd made the payments, that could be enough. Blazer first called early the previous June, trying to get Avila to send him documents showing he'd made the bribes. But Avila didn't quite remember the exact payment, and denied having any of the paperwork. So Blazer tried to guide him to discuss the older ones, from Panama and Uruguay. Avila resisted, explaining that, "We're not directly involved, because we do this with other companies, you see." Blazer called again at the end of June 2012, and this time got both Avila and his elder son, Stefano, who spoke English, on the line. He managed to get Stefano to admit to knowing about Tansy, the Uruguayan company used to funnel bribes, but it still seemed thin. And so the prosecutors came up with the idea of recording Avila at the London Olympics. That, too, had come up empty. Proof of intent aside, Avila presented another major obstacle. Brazil did not extradite its citizens. Even if the prosecutors built a perfect case, they couldn't touch Avila, so long as he was at home. So they dreamed up a new plan. Avila, they knew, came to Miami from time to time to check in on Traffic's local office. If they sat back and waited, perhaps they could make an approach the next time he came into the country, and catch him lying, or telling others to lie, then collar him and lean on him hard to cooperate. Lying to a federal agent was a crime in and of itself, and attempting to get others to lie or intentionally fail to cooperate was clear-cut obstruction of justice. The trick was for an agent to come in looking innocent and just get the person talking. Soon enough, they'd dig their own ditch. It was straight out of the FBI playbook. approach someone you already have dirt on, and try to catch them in a lie. When the opportunity finally arose in early May, the prosecutors sent Randall in the role of the young and ingenuous agent on a fishing expedition. They were banking on the fact that Avila wasn't an American, and was probably even more unprepared than most to deal with an FBI agent asking questions. The smart thing to do in that situation was to say nothing and get a lawyer. Happily for the investigators, Avila did no such thing. After his first encounter with Avila in the lobby, Randall returned to the Mandarin Oriental on May 9th, this time accompanied by Berryman. He asked the front desk clerk to call Avila's room and tell him to come down. The FBI agent had sworn out a criminal complaint for obstruction of justice the previous day in Brooklyn, then come back to Miami to make the arrest. Avila's flight back to Sao Paulo was scheduled for later that day, and he and his wife had packed their bags the night before. Now, instead of the airport, the 69-year-old was marched back up to his hotel room by the two agents, instructed to get dressed, and then escorted to the local FBI field office. Handcuffed to the wall in a bleak interview room, he was given a stark choice. He could, as was his legal right, insist on a court appearance to make an initial plea. It was already fairly late on Thursday, so he likely wouldn't get before a magistrate until the next day, in which case Avila would have to trade his street clothes for a prison jumpsuit and spend the night with hardened criminals in the Miami Federal Detention Center. Then he'd be transferred to Brooklyn, where the complaint had been filed, and he'd fly Con Air, the government's prisoner transport system, to get there, which meant a crazy itinerary around the country in a series of rickety old planes stuffed with scary inmates, rather than a direct flight. Once in New York, he'd face potentially more time in jail before even the possibility of bail arose. To top it off, the whole thing would be public, and he'd face the humiliation of people finding out he'd been arrested. It could even make the news in Brazil. Alternatively, Avila could waive his right to an appearance and agree to cooperate with the ongoing investigation of international soccer corruption. In that case, the agents explained to him, he'd fly commercial to New York that same day, be put up in a nice hotel, and not have to spend a single second in jail. Everything would be hush-hush, a big secret, and nobody would have to know. Avila had been wealthy for a long time. He flew first class when he wasn't on a private jet, ate at Michelin-starred restaurants, and stayed in $1,000-a-night hotels. He socialized with famous athletes and powerful businessmen. He spoke little English and was almost completely unfamiliar with the U.S. system of justice. But he'd seen enough movies to have strong opinions of American jails, overflowing with vicious gang members who preyed on the weak. Fighting the charge would certainly mean some time behind bars, at least until he made bail. And Avila wanted no part of that, not even for a minute. If cooperating meant getting out of the handcuffs and avoiding jail, then it really didn't feel like much of a choice at all. Avila signed the waiver and agreed to help. He would discover the true ramifications of that decision later. After the feds had taken her husband away from her, warning her not to tell anyone about what had happened, the first person Eliani Avila thought to call was Aaron Davidson. So far from home, Eliani had no idea who else to turn to. Davidson, the president of Traffic Sports USA, was the obvious choice. He was American, spoke Portuguese, and lived in a condo just across Brickell Key, a 5-minute walk from the hotel. Most importantly, she was sure he would be discreet, ensuring the arrest didn't end up in the gossip pages back home. Over the phone, near hysterical, she told Davidson that his boss had just been arrested and needed help. A 42-year-old lawyer who grew up in Dallas, Davidson had been at Traffic for a decade. He'd first met Avila when working as an attorney for Hicks Muse, the Texas-based private equity fund that briefly took a stake in the Brazilian firm in the late 1990s. In 2003, when Davidson was promoting a regional golf tour in Mexico, Avila recruited him to come to Miami and work for Traffic. Over time, Avila came to rely on Davidson to be his eyes and ears in the U.S. Davidson, meanwhile, grew deeply loyal to his boss. He looked up to him and considered him both a visionary marketing genius and a warm and encouraging father figure. Davidson raced to Eliani's side. He stayed with her until, hours later, Avila was finally permitted by the agents to call his wife and explain what was going on. Then Davidson drove to the Miami airport with a bag full of Avila's medication, handing it off to Randall and Berryman curbside. That evening, Davidson went out to eat with Eliani and Enrique Sanz. Over dinner, it was hard to talk about anything but the arrest. The news was shocking for everyone. Eliani was petrified, anguished for her spouse of 36 years, and didn't want to be alone. Davidson and Sanz, meanwhile, couldn't help but be worried. They'd been deeply wrapped up in traffic's dirty doings for years. None of them knew why Avila had been arrested, and the federal agents certainly hadn't been willing to share any information about the case. What exactly were the feds looking into? Chapter 21. I Am Not Your Friend. Avila began to proffer the morning after he was arrested. He initially stayed at the Plaza Athénée, a fancy hotel on New York's Upper East Side. But as it became clear the case would drag on for some time, he relocated to an apartment a friend loaned him in a building on 64th and Park, directly upstairs from Daniel, an elaborate Michelin three-star restaurant where the Brazilian frequently dined. Despite the considerable comforts of his lifestyle, Avila was constantly reminded of his newfound status as a presumptive criminal. For starters, he hated New York, where by his standards, too few people spoke Spanish or Portuguese. He was subject to a nighttime curfew and location monitoring, and obliged to wear an ankle bracelet with a built-in GPS location monitor. Anytime he wanted to go anywhere outside of a carefully circumscribed orbit, he had to call Jared Randall to get permission. Right up front, Norris had quizzed Avila extensively about his assets, and finally settled on a bond of $20 million, guaranteed by $5 million in cash, the deed to his brand-new condo on Fisher Island, and title to all of Avila's U.S. assets, including Traffic Sports USA, his Gold Cup and World Cup qualifier contracts, his stake in the North American Soccer League, and all his U.S. bank accounts. Avila also, of course, had to surrender his passport. Because of his work in soccer, Avila had traveled frequently for decades, but he was also very much a homebody. Other than the 2 years he spent in Boca Raton in the early 1990s, he had never lived outside Brazil, and he rarely left home for more than a week or two at a time. His family was in Brazil, as were his friends. Homesickness quickly began to define his life. The matter came to an uncomfortable head when Avila brought up his wife's birthday. Eliani was turning 60 on June 3, 2013, and Avila had planned an elaborate party for her in Sao Paulo. Between friends, family, and colleagues, the couple were expecting as many as 150 people to show up. Then on June 11th, Avila was turning 70, and he felt certain his three children were planning a surprise party in honor of the milestone. Missing those events, he told the prosecutors, would terminar minha vida, end my life. Not only that, he said, but it would raise suspicions back home. He was a public figure. People would notice his absence. They might even write about it in the sports or gossip pages. And that, he pleaded, could be bad for the case. Norris was unswayed. The answer was no. Brazil didn't extradite its citizens, and the risk that Avila would never return was far too great. But Norris didn't say that. Instead, he gingerly hinted that a return to Brazil could eventually be a reward for being helpful and truthful to the investigation. For the time being, the prosecutor suggested, Avila could throw Eliani's party in Miami and invite people to come up. Alternatively, he could send his wife back to Brazil for the party, along with his regrets, or simply cancel the whole thing. But for now, there was no way he was going home. But Avila was right about one thing. His extended absence did raise some issues. What he needed was a good cover story. The prosecutor suggested that he could tell people he was in the U.S. on business, trying to sell traffic. The due diligence process would give him a plausible excuse for requesting so much paperwork. Another idea was for Avila to tell people he was meeting with architects and supervising a major remodel of his new condo on Fisher Island. A third option, suggested by Hector, was blaming some kind of physical ailment. Avila considered blaming prostate cancer, but Sao Paulo was crawling with top-notch doctors, so the story seemed flimsy. He could blame ear issues, perhaps, or heart problems. Finally, the prosecutor settled on Avila telling people he was suffering panic attacks that prevented him from flying, and was seeking treatment, but until then couldn't travel. It was thin, and some folks in Brazil seemed suspicious, but it would have to do. The whole distasteful situation was a source of continual frustration for Avila. He was a man accustomed to enormous comforts and even greater liberties, an admired and powerful public figure, and now everything about his daily existence reminded him how all that had been taken away. Stuck in New York, Avila had little social life to speak of other than dining at expensive restaurants with his wife. All his phone calls, his interactions with traffic employees in Brazil and Miami, were wrapped in lies and deception. As he began to undertake covert operations for the prosecution, wearing a wire, he found himself spending increasing amount of time with Jared Randall. As the only Spanish speaker on the soccer case, Randall was delighted to be able to put his language skills to use while watching over Avila. The care and feeding of sources is, arguably, the thing the FBI does best. Agents are tasked with working directly with cooperators, keeping track of them, planning the details of their covert operations, and, when nothing in particular is going on in a case, simply being there for them. They attend proffers and take notes, keep an eye on them when they're in the field, and, when the day comes for them to testify at trial, help them prepare. A good agent must be a shrink, babysitter, and life coach, working tirelessly to keep cooperators motivated. In a sense, Randall had been by Avila's side the whole time, escorting him from the Mandarin Oriental to the Miami FBI office, sitting next to him in the last row of the American Airlines flight to New York, then guarding him during the tense few days before he was given bond and had to be watched around the clock. Among this new circle of people who controlled Avila's life, who asked him endless questions, demanded his records, and pushed him to confess every indiscretion, Randall stood out as someone he could talk to without feeling pressured, someone he trusted. But as an FBI agent, it was also Randall's duty to remind Avila of the true nature of their relationship. "Jose," Randall said, "no soy tu amigo. I am not your friend." It would be a mistake, Norris had told Avila in a conference room in the U.S. Attorney's office in Brooklyn, to try and guess what this investigation is about. It was the standard warning he gave every cooperator, reminding them that the only path forward was total honesty. Norris was good at keeping secrets, and shared almost nothing about the case with cooperators, including whom else he'd talked to. He made an effort to keep them in the dark about how the case developed and where it was going. At times, he even allowed them to believe things about the investigation that were not true, if he felt it could advance the work being done. Yet at the same time, Norris expected complete candor from cooperators. Avila was eager to earn his cooperation agreement. If Norris and the other prosecutors wanted him to help them gather evidence on more people, to expand the case, to provide their vaunted, substantial assistance, then he was happy to give them what they seemed to be asking for. Corruption in soccer was rampant, Avila said, and the people in the business were very dirty. It was about time, he said, in a refrain that was beginning to sound awfully familiar to Norris and the others, that somebody cleaned it up. Avila had started paying bribes in the late 1980s, he said, and began ticking off names of people who had taken money. They were the same people that Berryman and Norris had been talking about in their late-night conversations. The heavyweights of South America. Julio Grondona, the head of Argentina's soccer association, Nicolás Leoz, the former president of CONMEBOL, and Ricardo Teixeira, the ex-president of the Confederação Brasileira de Futebol, or CBF. Chuck Blazer also had taken money, as had Jack Warner. It was like a long-gripping history lecture, told not by some stodgy academic but by one of the real live actors in the drama, a general who had been on the front lines with the troops. Avila told the prosecutors about his early days at traffic, about brokering sponsorship deals with Brazil's soccer association when Teixeira took over and it had no money, first bringing in Pepsi, then Coca-Cola and Nike. He explained how many of those high-profile deals had involved multi-million-dollar payments to Teixeira, The Nike contract for $160 million over 10 years was by itself worth more than $2 million in annual marketing commissions from the American sportswear brand to Traffic, and Avila would secretly wire half that to Teixeira as a kickback. Avila told the prosecutors about his even more profitable rights deals and how he learned to pay bribes to soccer officials to push out competitors and keep prices low. And in particular, Avila talked about the Copa America. He recounted its origins, how he approached Nicolás Leoz with his ideas for turning the forgotten tournament into a moneymaker, and how Leoz and later Teixeira and Grondona, too, began demanding bribes with each new contract. The tournament had been a big moneymaker, Avila said, until the Argentine firm Full Play took it away from him following the 2011 edition. Without the Copa America, and with his business in general disarray, he was now completely out of the bribe-paying business, Avila said, and just wanted to sell Traffic and be done with it. He hadn't made any corrupt payments in 2 years, he insisted, but nonetheless patiently walked the prosecutors through the many complicated ways he had devised to send bribes in the past. His preferred method, he said, was using intermediaries with offshore companies that supplied him with bogus contracts he'd use to justify making payments. Those payments would then be forwarded to the intended bribe recipients in an arm's-length transaction originating in a neutral location like Panama. One of his trusted bagmen charged $150,000 a year for the service, not including commissions on every wire. What the investigators were hearing felt profoundly affirming. Berryman had already gone deep on all these big names, subpoenaing chips and Fedwire, finding bank accounts and subpoenaing those, too, until he had built a fat file on each potential suspect, uncovering a web of interconnected companies and payments that could only be explained as bribes. But to hear all that work validated by the man who was on the other end of those bribes was nothing short of thrilling. There was a palpable, electrifying feeling that they were very close to something big. The fire hose of information hardly stopped there. Avila supplied them new names to subpoena, and less than 2 weeks after his arrest, the prosecutors flew Avila down to Miami to start making recordings. Avila, unlike Blazer, found the idea of wearing a wire distasteful and dishonest. Affronted, he pushed back. But the prosecutors were clear. He had no choice. At their behest, he reached out to Ricardo Teixeira. The two men hadn't talked in years, but Teixeira had been living in a spectacular waterfront Miami mansion since early 2012, and the opportunity seemed ripe. According to Avila, the former soccer official had taken tens of millions of dollars in bribes. He'd left Brazil only because he was being investigated by police there for his involvement in a massive fraud scheme related to a friendly match. Teixeira seemed happy to hear from his old colleague, but he denied involvement in anything untoward, and the initial recordings, at least, didn't prove too fruitful. Avila had also been asked to go to lunch with Enrique Sanz wearing a wire. That meeting's main objective was to see if Sanz would confess to having made bribe payments to Jack Warner in the late 1990s and early 2000s, when he was still at Traffic. But Sanz seemed to dance around the issue, changing the subject and saying nothing. The prosecutors also wanted Avila to try to figure out whether Sanz suspected anything about the investigation, given the risk that word of his arrest might have leaked out. According to Avila, Sanz had no clue, and a story Avila told about the feds focusing only on Blazer and Warner, and possible tax issues, seemed to have convinced Sanz that his former boss wasn't involved. For Norris and the others, those initial recordings hadn't produced a smoking gun or some admission of guilt. But they nevertheless marked an auspicious starting point. Avila was promising to provide detailed breakdowns of each of the many corrupt schemes he'd been involved in over the years, dating back to the late 1980s and early 1990s, and pledged to provide copies of all the relevant documents. It was going fantastically, the investigators all agreed. The rich old Brazilian might be a bit stuffy and sensitive, but he was proving to be one hell of a cooperator. None of them suspected that Avila might not be telling them the whole story. Soon after the March meeting in Buenos Aires to discuss the Copa America, Alejandro Bursaco of Torneos flew to Zurich, where the FIFA Expo was holding its quarterly meetings. Burzacco used the opportunity to sit down for lunch with Enrique Sanz, Aaron Davidson of Traffic, and Mariano Hinkes from Full Play to negotiate the final missing component of the deal, CONCACAF's participation in the Centenario edition of the tournament. The offer on the table from the new partnership, Datisa, had been $40 million to the Confederation for its broadcast and commercial rights, and $7 million to bribe Jeffrey Webb to sign the contract. But Sanz said Webb wanted more. The CONCACAF president had heard rumors about a much larger total pot of payments for South American officials, and infuriated at what he perceived to be an insultingly low offer, demanded an incredible $15 million just for himself. Finally, Burzacco was able to negotiate the bribe down to $10 million, still a massive payment by any measure, with the Confederation's above-the-board share dropping to $35 million. With that last hurdle cleared, the contract could be completed, and in late May, about the same time that Avila was making his first clandestine recordings for the Justice Department, Burzacco flew around the world gathering the necessary signatures from the key soccer officials. As a kind of signing bonus, the heads of 9 South American national associations would be getting bribes, as would the new president of CONMEBOL, Eugenio Figueiredo, and its general secretary. By the time the 2023 Copa America took place, the sum of bribes paid for the tournament would surpass $100 million. It was the largest scheme any of the participants had ever been involved in.
Everything was in place, and now was Avila's turn to chip in his share of the first rounds of bribes.
On June 3rd, less than a month after he was arrested, Avila personally authorized a wire of $5 million from Traffic's account at Delta National Bank in Miami to an account in Switzerland, controlled by Burzacco. 3 days later, he signed a second wire instruction, sending another $5 million to a different Swiss account, controlled by Hugo and Mariano Hinkes. The balance of two payments of $1.67 million owed to each of his partners, bringing Avila's total contribution to $13.33 million, would be sent 3 months later. Both wires, as is to be expected for international transactions originating in the U.S., passed through American correspondent banks and would have been easily traceable, but only if someone had been looking for them. Chapter 22. One is silver, the other gold. Steve Berryman climbed slowly up the four flights of stairs to Zorana Danis's office on Tuesday, September 24th, 2013, wondering if he was in the right place. He had been meticulously researching Danis for months, ever since Avila brought up her name in connection to South American soccer corruption. The IRS agent, still struggling to get in shape a year after his heart surgery, was heading for the top floor of an old brick warehouse across the street from an industrial supply shop, and an overgrown empty lot in a down-in-the-heels section near downtown Jersey City. A few glints of gentrification had begun to crop up in the neighborhood, but for the most part it looked rough, just about the last place Berryman would expect an important player in world soccer to be based. Yet there it was, the headquarters of International Soccer Marketing, the company Danis owned and operated. Berryman made a point of looking up financial records for every suspect in the case, but Danis had stood out. And not just because she was the rare woman involved in such a male-dominated industry. She wasn't a citizen, but she was based in the U.S. And, he soon discovered, she had an account at Citibank, which meant he could aggressively subpoena her accounts with no fear she'd catch wind of what he was up to. What Berryman found was encouraging. There were dozens of payments, big, juicy six-figure ones, to bank accounts in Switzerland, Paraguay, and Uruguay, over a period of many years. Over one 30-month period, for example, Berryman traced just over $2 million in payments that his gut told him had to be bribes of some kind. Many of the recipient accounts looked as though they could be related to Nicolás Leos, the former CONMEBOL president, who Avila had said was close to Danis. He'd pulled her taxes, too, and combing through them found she'd made a suspicious deduction a few years earlier that looked an awful lot like trying to write off a bribe as a legitimate business expense. Even more intriguing was Danis's background. Berryman, who spent most of his time reading soccer history when he wasn't working through his voluminous subpoenas, discovered that Danis had soccer in her blood. Her father had been a goalie who played 8 games for the Yugoslavian national team in the late 1950s, winning a gold medal at the 1960 Olympics. A flamboyant and charismatic Macedonian, Blagoje Vidinic was a chain-smoker known for singing opera during matches to keep his teammates on their toes, and was, briefly, considered one of Europe's most promising young goalkeepers. His prospects never fully panned out, and after bouncing around clubs in Europe, he ended his career playing for a series of low-rent teams in Los Angeles, San Diego, and St. Louis during the early days of American pro soccer. Vidinic went on to become an international coach, taking Morocco's national team to the 1970 World Cup and Zaire's to the 1974 tournament. En route, he fell in with Horst Dassler, the Adidas boss credited with inventing modern sports marketing, who would go on to found the hugely successful and highly corrupt firm ISL. Dassler had outfitted Vidinic's teams with free Adidas gear, and Vidinic repaid the favor on the eve of FIFA's landmark presidential elections in June 1974. Sharing a drink in the lobby bar of a Frankfurt hotel on the eve of the vote, Vidinic informed Dassler that he had been backing the wrong horse. Sir Stanley Roos, the English incumbent, was going to lose, Vidinic informed him, because his Brazilian rival, João Avalanche, had won over Africa's large voting bloc. Scrambling, Dassler rushed to Avalanche's room to offer the future FIFA president his support, launching what became one of the most influential relationships in the history of sports. The incident also cemented an enduring friendship between Dassler and Vidinic, who would work for Adidas for many years. Danis was born while her father played for a club in Belgrade, and she followed him around the world on his soccer adventures. When she was a teenager, her father coached the national team in Colombia, where she picked up Spanish. In 1989, not long after graduating from Georgetown, she and her father founded International Soccer Marketing in order to buy and sell soccer sponsorship rights. By the late 1990s, she landed what would be her meal ticket, the Copa Libertadores, South America's annual international club championship. Although CONMEBOL handled the tournament's TV rights separately, Danis was in charge of the sponsorship end, and had sold the rights to the likes of Toyota, Santander, and Bridgestone. The millions of dollars in suspect payments flowing out of her accounts, Berryman decided, looked a lot like bribes to Leos and other officials to ensure she'd continue to receive those rights. It was the exact kind of thing he'd seen with traffic. In mid-July, Norris put a pen register on Danis to try to get a sense of whom she talked to. Meanwhile, the team strategized about the best way to make an approach. With a husband and 2 kids in the U.S., Danis didn't seem like a flight risk, so an arrest seemed a bit heavy-handed. But given what Berryman had gathered, they certainly could put a good scare into her. Berryman opted for a softer approach. He figured Danis would assume American law enforcement, particularly a numbers-focused IRS agent wouldn't know anything about soccer. So he'd play it dumb to see if she let anything slip. As he did before all his interviews, Berryman wrote out a detailed outline of how he wanted things to go, much the same way some athletes visualize scoring a goal or winning a race. "I'm based out in California," Berryman said, sitting in her office. "I'm looking into something and ran across some foreign payments from your company involving something called FIFA?" He deliberately mangled that last word, pronouncing it FIFA, and letting it hang in the air as he put a blank expression on his face. He was there with a rookie IRS agent out of Orange County named J.J. Kasich, who had recently been assigned to help Berryman. With a boyish face, Kasich looked very young, and unlike the older agent, truly did know nothing about soccer, so his presence only made the act more believable. "It was no big deal," Berryman hastily added, "just a boring tax case. He'd pulled some bank records and seen some money moving overseas, and was just wondering what they were all about, that's all." Then he read off a list of wires originating from her account that he'd carefully selected beforehand. They were ones he felt certain weren't bribes, but instead legitimate payments to vendors. That way, Berryman figured, she'd assume he had no clue what she was up to. Again, he repeated, it was no big deal. But would she mind pulling a few records to show what those payments were for? Danis, tall and slender, looked puzzled, but also relieved. She agreed, and Berryman, keeping up the Inspector Clouseau act, gathered his papers, thanked her, and left, Kasich trailing after him. On November 18th, Norris and the other prosecutors gave Darian Warner the cooperation agreement he'd been craving since his arrest, allowing him to plead guilty to just 3 criminal counts in a cleared federal courtroom in Brooklyn. Although he'd been pinched for structuring, the prosecutors had, over months of questioning, determined that Jack Warner's eldest child had, in fact, taken part in a number of other corrupt schemes, many involving soccer. For starters, he'd moved a great deal more cash around for far longer than Berryman had detailed in his complaint. Moreover, working with a string of partners, Warner had been scalping World Cup tickets for nearly 2 decades, dating back at least to the 1994 World Cup in the U.S. Most importantly, he'd helped his father take the $10 million bribe from the South African Bid Committee for the 2010 World Cup, the same payment that had eventually exacerbated tensions between Blazer and Warner in the months before they went at each other's throat. There was little question that Darian, and to some degree his kid brother Daryl, were in deep. But there were also limits to what the two could be asked to do against their own father. When it became clear that Daryl Warner had limited knowledge of other conspiracies, the prosecutors moved on, giving him a cooperation agreement and letting him plead guilty to 2 non-soccer-related counts in mid-July. It was the case's first conviction, but the younger Warner brother had proven a somewhat disappointing cooperator. His older brother had seemed to hold more promise, given his more enterprising spirit when it came to the family soccer business. He'd been willing to provide evidence against others, and to make consensual recordings or wear a wire if necessary. But the people he could inform on proved less interesting than hoped. In the end, Darian Warner simply couldn't deliver, especially when compared to Havila, who seemed to have bribed every big-name official in the hemisphere. By letting him plead guilty, Norris was giving Darian Warner what every cooperator wants, a promise that the prosecution will ask for leniency from the judge when it comes to sentencing. Once the plea was official, the formal proffers ended. Warner's movements were still restricted. He was still out on $5 million bond, guaranteed by $600,000 in cash and 8 properties. And he was still subject to GPS location monitoring with tight travel restrictions. But mainly all he had to do was await sentencing. Warner had pleaded guilty to 2 criminal conspiracy charges related to scalping, as well as the original structuring charge he'd been arrested on. Moving money around, or even hiding it, isn't a crime by itself. It's only money laundering if the funds are in some way dirty, meaning that they are the proceeds of a separate crime, like fraud or embezzlement, and someone is trying to wash them. As a result, money laundering charges come coupled with at least 1 prior or predicate offense. In the case of Darian Warner, the predicate was wire fraud. He had conspired with others to lie to FIFA about his plans for the tickets it had allocated, telling the organization he wouldn't be scalping them, and he used email, a kind of electronic communications wire, to help commit the deception. The money laundering piece came after he had scalped the tickets and then used international bank transfers to distribute, and thus hide, the profits of the conspiracy. By statute, those crimes carried a combined prison sentence of up to 40 years. But nobody expected Warner to serve anywhere near that, given his clean prior record and willingness to cooperate. Much more painful in some ways was the $1,177,843.95 that he'd agreed to forfeit to the U.S. government, representing a portion of the monies that the defendant received from ticket sales in connection with the 2006 FIFA World Cup. It was considerably more than FIFA's own auditors had determined were the profits from the scheme in the first place, but just a drop in the bucket compared to what the American investigation would soon begin to bring in. The second time Berryman went to see Danis, he rode out from Manhattan with John Penza of the FBI. Penza was a former New Jersey cop who had made the jump to the Bureau and worked for years alongside Mike Gaeta on Italian Mafia cases. Gaeta loved Penza, and when the opportunity arose, convinced him to come over to C-24, the Eurasian Organized Crime Squad, as his second-in-command. Then word came that Geta had won a coveted assignment to work full-time as an assistant legal attaché in the U.S. Embassy in Rome. It was a plum posting, usually reserved for guys late in their careers, and impossible to turn down. Geta would be leaving New York early in 2014, and he'd be gone for at least 2 years, if not longer, which meant Penza would be taking over the squad. The soccer case had become one of C-24's biggest, and worth learning more about. So Penza, who had a thick pompadour of shiny black hair, cut by a single streak of gray,
and was fond of expensive showy suits,
was eager to ride along. On the drive out, Berryman congratulated him on his impending promotion. Dennis had found the documents Berryman had requested, but they were a red herring and he didn't care what they said. He just needed a pretext to meet her in person again, which he did in the second week of November. "This is Special Agent Penza," Berryman said to Dennis, intentionally avoiding mentioning that he was from the FBI, because he wanted to keep up the illusion that this was just a boring tax case. He had come back to New Jersey, he went on, to talk about the wire transfers in more detail. But Berryman soon began describing a different set of wires than he had before. The ones he was confident were, in fact, bribes. He asked Dennis about them innocently, not letting on that he knew what they were. "This $250,000 wire," he inquired, a perplexed look on his face, "made on October 21, 2008, from your Citibank account to a Banco do Brasil account in Paraguay. Now, what was that for? How about this wire, for the same amount and to the same account on December 15th? And what about the $800,000, spread out over six wires sent in a two-year span to a Merrill Lynch account in Uruguay? What was that all about?" As he went through the long series of transfers, Berryman carefully observed Dennis's face. He began to detect a slow but palpable change. Without ever saying where he was going, he was laying out almost his entire case against her. Then, after nearly an hour, Berryman suddenly changed his tone. "Zorana," he said, leaning away from the papers piled on his lap and staring at her intently in the face. "Should we knock this off and talk about why I'm really here?" There was a long and uncomfortable pause. It must have been five full seconds. "I know why you're here," Dennis said quietly. "The payments." "What payments?" Berryman asked, his dark eyes narrowing. "You mean the bribes?" "Yes, the payments," she replied, a note of resignation in her voice. "In South America." Like her father, Dennis was a smoker, and she suddenly felt the urgent need for a smoke. "Do you mind if I step out for a cigarette break?" she added. "Sure," Berryman said. "But don't call anyone." Dennis left the men sitting in her office while she escaped momentarily, clutching a pack of Marlboro Reds. While they waited, Penza, who had been quietly taking notes, looked up, a small grin on his face. When Dennis returned a few minutes later, she looked calmer and seemed resolved to tell her story. She wasn't smiling, but she looked relieved, almost thankful, that the truth was coming out at last. And she sat at her desk, ready to talk. The two agents ended up staying all day. Chuck Blazer's health had been in steady decline. Weighing upward of 450 pounds, Blazer found it increasingly difficult to walk for anything longer than short distances. He did no exercise, exacerbating his other conditions, which included type 2 diabetes and coronary heart disease, and was on a steady regimen of pills to keep the symptoms in check. The undercover work he had done at the Olympics was exhausting, and in November 2012, Blazer collapsed, ending up in the hospital with an acute bout of pneumonia. When he finally returned home, he did so with an oxygen tank strapped to his mobility scooter. Then in the spring of 2013, he was diagnosed with rectal cancer, requiring 20 weeks of chemotherapy, followed by radiation treatment. Depending on how effective that proved, he'd likely have to undergo surgery that would leave him, at least temporarily, with a colostomy bag. As Blazer's health declined, so did his usefulness as a cooperator. He no longer had any official position within soccer at any level, and after CONCACAF released its report on him and Warner the previous April, he was a pariah in the sport. there was little chance he could get anyone to admit anything serious. So pushing Blazer to make more recordings not only seemed cruel, given his health problems, but pointless. At 10:10 in the morning on November 25, 2013, Blazer wheeled into Judge Raymond J. Deary's courtroom in Cadman Plaza, flanked by his lawyers, ready to confess to what amounted to a very limited sampling of his decades of criminal activity in soccer.
He wouldn't face punishment for helping Warner get a bribe from the Moroccan World Cup bid committee in 1992,
or for scalping tickets in the 1994, 1998, and 2002 World Cups, which he'd admitted to, or for the hundreds of thousands of dollars in bribes he'd taken from Avila in exchange for the Gold Cup rights. There were to be no charges for willingly failing to file CONCACAF's tax returns, or for the many other fiduciary indiscretions he'd perpetuated as the Confederation's General Secretary.
Instead, Blazer was being allowed to plead to the tax counts that Berryman had dug up, as well as a single wire fraud conspiracy charge and a related money laundering conspiracy charge for his role in taking bribes to vote for South Africa to host the 2010 World Cup.
He'd have to forfeit nearly $2 million to the government. There was one additional, incredibly significant, crime he would have to plead to as well. Blazer had been an invaluable cooperator, opening the prosecutor's eyes to the pervasive rot that ran through seemingly every level of soccer and the sports marketing companies that lubricated the system with bribes. He had delivered them Habila and handed over a river of evidence on dozens of other suspects, chief among them Jack Warner. Perhaps most importantly, Blazer had helped the prosecutors grasp the premise that FIFA and all the many confederations and associations that radiated out from it operated as a single, cohesive, corrupted enterprise. Thus, it was fitting that Blazer would be the first defendant in the case to confess to a RICO violation. The principal purpose of the enterprise, Blazer's charging document read, was to regulate and promote the sport of soccer worldwide. Yet he and other soccer officials had corrupted the enterprise by engaging in various criminal activities, including fraud, bribery, and money laundering in pursuit of personal gain, and by abusing positions of trust, engaging in undisclosed self-dealing, misappropriating funds, and violating their fiduciary duties. Looking down at Blazer, a sick and broken man, Judge Deary, who was known among lawyers for his often humorous touch from the bench, took on a somber tone as he asked how Blazer pleaded. "Guilty," he replied. Almost 2 years to the day after he had been confronted in the glass atrium adjoining Trump Tower, it was at last time to let Chuck Blazer rest. Chapter 23. Trust and Betrayal. For the first dozen years of his career, Enrique Sanz was on the hustle side of the soccer business, attending to the needs of the self-important presidents, vice presidents, and treasurers of even the puniest soccer associations scattered around the Caribbean and Central America, so they would sign the rights contracts traffic needed. That all changed when Sanz was made CONCACAF's general secretary in mid-2012. Suddenly, he was the one in demand, the one to whom everybody came bearing gifts. He had attended soccer conferences and other events for years, joining the crowd of hungry sports marketing guys standing at the back of the room, praying for an opportunity to buttonhole some official after listening to him give some tiresome speech. Now, Sanz was the one taking the podium at Congresses, and when he looked out across the room, he could spot the eager young salesman salivating in his direction. It was hard not to enjoy the fresh aura of importance that came with the job. The sporting press sometimes even referred to him as a dignitary, particularly when he appeared alongside FIFA President Sepp Blatter. The money wasn't bad either. Sanz's salary as general secretary was $800,000 a year, a massive bump from what he got at traffic. And among the many perks of the job were a seemingly unlimited expense account and a shiny new BMW X5 sport utility vehicle, which proved useful for making frequent trips between the CONCACAF and traffic offices to negotiate new rights deals. On November 15, 2013, for example, Sanz sat down with his close friend, Aaron Davidson, Traffic Sports USA's president, to hammer out final details on a renewed Gold Cup contract that would hand the sports marketing firm rights to the tournament all the way through 2021. For years, the two contemporaries had worked as a team, with Sands acquiring rights from soccer officials and Davidson turning around and reselling those rights to TV stations and sponsors. When Sands left